is Monday, March 19th. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. Broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to the UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Good evening. It is 5:05 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. We will also talk to Anne Bathistel from Stop UBC Animal Research, and Kaylee Astle from 5 Days from the Homeless, and Mika Buckley-Pearson from World MUN for some insight into campus happenings.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for UBC campus headlines and local headlines. In a letter sent Thursday, March 15th to the activist group Stop UBC Animal Research, the Canadian Council on Animal Care, the CCAC, finds no evidence to support allegations of animal cruelty made against a University of British Columbia research team. On February 22, 2012, Stop UBC Animal Research wrote the national agency responsible for the oversight of animals in Canadian research institutions, the CCAC. The group demanded an investigation into the deaths of 4 macaque monkeys during the course of a research project on Parkinson's disease. The study involved macaque monkeys and was conducted from 2000 to 2009 and involved the injection of a drug to induce Parkinson's-like symptoms in order to establish the best way to test promising treatments against the disease. CCAC Executive Director Clément Gauthier stated in a letter, quote, "Our inquiry revealed no evidence to support the allegations. The study was conducted in a CCAC-certified institution according to an approved research protocol and within CCAC standards in place in 2007, end quote. UBC Vice President of Research and International John Hepburn stated, quote, "The CCAC vindicates the careful, humane, and ethical way our researchers treat the animals in their care. Scientists at UBC take their responsibilities extremely seriously. We fully appreciate that animal research is a public trust, not a right," end quote. We're joined on the phone now by Anne Bathistel from Stop UBC Animal Research. So, hi, Anne. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks, Claire.
So, Anne, what can you tell us about Stop UBC's reaction to this? I know you guys have definitely put a lot of work into this this letter and this project that you have about this the research project on Parkinson's disease. And how does it feel to have that ruling come back from the CCAC?
Well, we're not surprised in one aspect. We because the Canadian Council on Animal Care will allow severe pain protocols involving severe pain above the pain tolerance threshold of unanesthetized animals. So we're not at all surprised that they would find that the euthanizing of these monkeys was par for the course. What we're concerned now with is that they have not looked at her subsequent work. The same researcher intended in her follow-up progress report to kill at least 4 more monkeys in order to scan their damaged brains.
Mm-hmm.
She's causing brain damage in monkeys and deliberately killing them so that she can harvest the tissue. You know? So we're deeply disturbed about this and the fact that from what we find, she's encouraged to use pilot studies which don't need full ACC approval, full ACC review and approval.
And do you expect the CCAC will be looking into her follow-up work then, or do you think they're just going to leave it?
If I'm from their letter, it looks as though they're just going to leave it. They're satisfied with the fact that this happens, that the monkeys were killed as part of this mm-hmm. process. But what we're saying is that it wasn't accidentally, it wasn't an overdose of a drug. It was a powerful neurotoxin that she administered that killed these well, that caused these animals to be so brain damaged and she had to kill them. But in her follow-up protocols, instead of being more careful, making sure that no more animals suffered in that way, she is intentionally killing them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the monkeys, they talk about 5 monkeys, or actually 18 monkeys in the study. And of those 18, 14 went on to be recycled into other research projects, possibly her own project, in which she'll be damaging their brains further. They were disabled, so they were suffering the symptoms of Parkinsonism, the rigors, the tremors, the lack of motor skills, and the terror of what was happening to them, but allowed to go on into other research projects.
Anne, I just wanted to ask you, in the Stop UBC Animal Research's response to the council's letter, you said that Dr. Dudet's studies did not receive full Animal Care Committee review and approval. Could you comment more about that? How did she go ahead with the studies despite this, despite the fact?
Sorry, the subsequent studies, it's all part of the the Parkinson's disease and aging diseases that the team is studying. Jonathan A. Stossel being the principal investigator of CIHR team in Parkinson's disease and in aging. I lost the question, sorry,
yeah, but I mean, what degree of power does the Animal Care Committee have in terms of approval for such studies?
Well, this is part of the pilot studies, and pilot studies do not require full ACC approval and review. There are subcommittees. We found there are subcommittees, but who exactly is on those subcommittees, and is there a community representative looking out for the animals on these committees? We know now that the BCSDCA, for some reason, has left the ACC, which came as a shock to us, because they had said that if they weren't there to speak out for the animals, who would? And now we find that the BCSPCA has actually withdrawn from the committee. So we don't know who is speaking up for the animals. We don't know who would possibly have signed off on this egregious type of cruelty if they were actually representing the animals.
That's right.
So what's next for Stop UBC? What's the next step you guys are planning on taking for this project?
Well, we're still hoping that the BCSPCA will thoroughly investigate all the studies that this doctor is doing, but we are consulting with our attorneys, and we're considering legal action to step in and protect the monkeys.
Great. Well, that sounds great. Thanks, Anne. It was great talking to you, and best of luck with your future projects.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So you heard, that was Anne Berthissel from Stop UBC Animal Research that we had just discussing how the Canadian Council on Animal Care had found no evidence to support allegations of animal cruelty that they had made against a UBC research team. So we'll see what comes with that in the future. So we're going to take a quick break, but stay with us for more of your campus headlines. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
This month in Discorder. This month's cover features the experimental punk band Shearing Pinks, three dudes who have been an underground Vancouver staple since 2005 and have over 50 releases, big and small, under their belts. Also featured this month are The Bleeding Hearts, who released their debut EP this month, a review on Wim Wenders' latest film, the 3D dance epic Pina, an update on the Rio's ongoing battle to show movies and serve liquor, not to mention a bunch of excellent show and album reviews, and all of your regular features. Pick up your beautiful and free copy of Discorder at any Friends of CITR business, or if you've gone paperless, don't forget to check out Discorder at discorder.ca. Discorder, that magazine from CITR, supporting local music for over 25 years.
And welcome back to CITR News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Claire and CJ, and we have more of your campus headlines.
Well, on Friday, the AMS applied to the Labor Relations Board for a mediator who has the power to impose a collective bargaining agreement between the two sides. This came after the unions moved to end talks and initiate a work stoppage. The AMS had the right under provincial law to unilaterally apply for mediation, as this is the first contract negotiation between the two sides since the security workers unionized in September. The mediator has the power to either impose a settlement or determine that the union should be allowed to commence with job action. Chera Hodge, communications representative for the workers' union, COPE 378, was confident that a mediator would produce a favorable settlement. The key issue is that the union disagrees with the wage proposal offered by the AMS that proposes lower wages for new staff in order to pay for current staff pay increases. As per the new wage proposal, new employees would start at $10.50 an hour compared to the $11.50 an hour that current staff earn. That wage would increase by 50 cents at 2,000 hours and 4,000 hours of work. In comparison, in 2008, incoming employees were hired at $16 an hour. AMS President Matt Parson said the society was in the midst of evaluating the cost of the union proposals. Parson said he hoped that subservices would continue as usual in the event of a strike, but said contingency plans are not yet finalized. Meanwhile, the Labor Relations Board has until March 23rd to appoint a mediator.
A recent letter signed by the presidents of the 25 publicly funded university and colleges in BC, which include UBC President Stephen Toop, argues that service cuts will come if the provincial government cuts funding to post-secondary education. The letter says that it is unrealistic to assume that the reductions proposed by the budget of 2012 can be achieved without implications for student services. This argument by these 25 presidents contradicts the government's claim that the $70 million funding gap, can be overcome through administrative savings and that neither student services nor research would be affected. The letter, which is addressed to Advanced Education Minister Naomi Yamamoto, also expressed the concern that the post-secondary sector was the only sector that received an overall funding reduction. Michelle Mungall, the NDP's critic for advanced education, stressed the importance of the letter. She said, quote, "This has never happened before in BC's history, where all the presidents of public post-secondary institutions come together in a unified voice to express their dismay and what I interpret as their lack of confidence in the Liberal government and the minister." She also argued that because the letter was sent out on February 28th, 7 days after the budget announcement, it indicated a lack of consolidation between the ministry and institutions.
Bill 22 is now law, and teachers in British Columbia are exploring all options. The BC Teachers Federation are holding their annual meeting. At the top of the agenda is how teachers are going to respond to being legislated back to work. Susan Lambert, head of the BCTF, told reporters this afternoon she is prepared to back illegal job action if the members of the organization choose to do so. Bill 22 imposes a fine of over $1 million a day to the BCTF if they engage in any job action, and fines of just under $500 per day for individuals. Despite the financial implications this will have for the BCTF, it is a course that the 700 delegates and 41,000 members are considering during their annual meeting. Other options on the table include withdrawing volunteer support staff from extracurricular activities. Teachers are expected to outline their tactical response to Bill 22 either at midnight Wednesday or early Wednesday morning.
And those were your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We are now joined in studio by Mika Buckley-Pearson from the Vancouver World Model UN Committee, and she is here with us today. So welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So just give us a brief outline of what happened this last week. We know you had a lot of delegates in town and a lot of hard work was put in. And would you say it was a success overall?
Yeah, it was definitely a success. I guess I could give you a bit of background on WorldMun. It's one of the largest undergraduate conferences in the entire world. It's organized annually by Harvard University and a partner host committee. And this year we brought it to Vancouver. So we've been working for some of us for the past year, some of us for 1 year, getting ready for this five-day conference. It combines daily committee sessions with nightly social events. So we had about 2,000 delegates from over 60 countries.
Wow, that must have been quite the logistical challenge, I can imagine. What was some of the feedback you received from participants?
Very positive feedback overall. I mean, I would like to say it was the best World Mon ever, but it was my first, so I guess I can't go there. But we definitely had some delegates say that. And we also had 300 volunteers, and many of which were from UBC, and they all had a really positive experience.
I read the UBC newspaper reported that the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon sent out a video to the World Moon. Could you tell us what he said in that briefly?
Yeah, sure. It was actually a letter, not a video, which he sent us sort of congratulating us on our participation in such a project and emphasizing the importance of youth getting involved in sort of international issues and that. We're at a big time of change with climate change and rising global poverty and food security and all of these issues that were discussed at World Mon. And was congratulating us, both delegates and host committee, for participating in something and encouraging youth to get involved because we are the future leaders.
And do you see some of these participants potentially going back to their communities and giving back in ways and through methods they've learned at the World Moon?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think I definitely met a few global leaders out there. Who knows, maybe some future presidents, prime ministers, maybe even a secretary general of the United Nations. We also have a project during the conference called the Social Venture Challenge or the Resolution Project, which encourages delegates to create a development project, whether in their own country or in another country. And they have to create a plan, a project plan and everything. And then the winning delegates receive funding. So there is an action component along with the conference.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
Were you able to see some of those proposals over the weekend? Or over the week, rather?
I heard about a few of them, but it was a little bit crazy for those of us working kind of running everywhere. I remember one of the winners was about waste collection and management, but I actually can't remember the country. I can remember there's some of them from last year were about water security and access to water in Kenya. One of the winners was an Australian team, and it was about working with the Maori in Australia, but I can't remember the particular development aspect.
Yeah. Wow, I mean, that sounds like a really great project. What were some of the countries and schools that the students were from? And was it really, like, I guess, like a global partnership? Or?
Yeah, it's very diverse. Like I said, it's over 60 countries were represented. It tends to be the majority Europeans, but... Mm-hmm. Not so large a majority, so we get lots of Germans and French especially, but then also quite a few Asian universities were represented from China, Japan, and then Indonesia, India, also some African delegations. There was one from Kenya, South Africa, and then the Latin Americans, who are always very well represented and very loud and boisterous as well. The best delegation was a Venezuelan one, I believe.
Okay. So where is the World Mon going next?
They'll announce the next city, I believe, in April. So what happens is at every World Mon, a new city or university bids to host it next year. So we're not sure yet.
Well, congratulations once again on what sounded like a great week, and it was great to have you in studio to talk to us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So that was Mika Buckley-Pearson from the Vancouver World Model UN, which took place last week quite successfully, as we just heard. We're going to take a quick break right now, but please do stay with us for your provincial headlines. You're listening to CITR News 101.
The UBC Ski and Snowboard Club is a nonprofit, democratic, student-run organization dedicated to promoting the sports of skiing and snowboarding and the associated lifestyle.
We endeavor to make skiing and snowboarding accessible and fun by actively seeking out the best deals and discounts for our members, as well as organizing trips to local ski areas and setting up numerous social events.
Come on one of our legendary trips and explore the glory of riding in British Columbia. Or join us at the bar to discover the true meaning of debauchery. Ask your roommate, ask your parents, ask the RCMP. Who has the most fun at UBC? You'll get the same answer. The Ski and Snowboard Club.
Yeah. Joining the Ski and Board Club is easy. Come by our office, sub 115, anytime with some money to become a member. Your membership gives you access to all the deals offered by our sponsors, cheap beverages at our parties, an invitation to all club events, and of course, only members can come on the trips.
Yeah.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia. We are now joined in studio by Kaylee Assel from 5 Days from the Homeless right here in Vancouver, BC. So Kaylee, welcome to News 101.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as some of our listeners might know, and I personally know, 5 Days for the Homeless is a nationwide campaign started in the University of Ottawa. Students are stay out for 5 days to spread awareness and raise money for youth homeless. So tell us, how successful was this campaign?
This year it was really successful. It takes place in 22 campuses across Canada. And here at UBC, we were one of like the top 3 or 4 schools, which we're really proud about because we didn't have as much support from National compared to a lot of the other schools. Mm-hmm. And we're also not a founding school. So with just the resources that we have, we are sitting right now at $18,427.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah, we're really excited. So we're only $1,500 away from $20,000. And this is also the most that UBC's ever raised. So I'm bragging a little bit, but I'm pretty stoked about the money. And it's all going to Directions Youth Services, which is it's a youth charity in downtown Vancouver. And it's not a shelter. It's more of kind of a stepping stone to get youth off the street.
Yeah. Could you give our listeners a sense of what the participants go through during those 5 days?
Yeah, sure. So I actually know because I was a participant in my first year. But every year we have 10 students. They sleep outside the UBC bookstore and they forego all basic necessities. They only wear the clothes that are on their back. They have a sleeping bag and a pillow, and that's about it. They can only eat what's donated to them and they have no disposable income. That's kind of what it looks like from the outside, but from the inside, they're going through an emotional roller coaster. They're eating the worst food and just like bread and carbs and nothing that gives you energy. They barely get any sleep. They were so emotional. And I remember I felt the same emotion. And so once they start meeting the people, they got to meet the people where the money was going to, some of the youth down on the streets. And I think that really gave them a tangible reason as to why they're there. And you could just see them change throughout the experience. And it's a really humbling experience.
Yeah, I was definitely, I read through some of the blog postings of the volunteers this year. And some of them were really happy that they got to meet some of the youth that came by from Directions. Right? I mean, you remember that time mm-hmm. a couple of years ago. It was quite an experience, an eye-opener to see them talk about them not having parents and walking the entire country to come to Vancouver and not be able to find anything. You know, it's quite an experience.
It is, especially when I think it's one thing to know that, oh, like this $20,000 is going to this charity. But then when you are face to face with some of the kids that you're helping, it's a whole different ballgame for these participants. When you're meeting someone and you hear the story about the terrible things that happened in their life and why they're on the streets, you realize, wow, I'm done stereotyping these people and just thinking, oh, they're addicted to drugs. You realize that their parents kicked them out of their house because maybe they're homosexual or their parents died in a car accident, so they hitchhiked all the way to Vancouver when they're only 11 years old. I mean, these stories, they hit close to home and you realize that those stereotypes get pushed aside and these are real people just like us. We're overprivileged youth helping underprivileged youth, right?
Yep. I remember that tagline from a while back.
It's a good one.
Yeah. Apart from going to the classes to spread awareness, these participants also have other activities. Could you tell us what else they did?
Yeah, absolutely. So the campaign started a little bit earlier than 5 days. We were really fortunate this year. We saw the campaign grow immensely because we were actually... we were approached by Virgin Mobile and Campus Perks, and they wanted us to kind of start campaigning early, which we decided to do. And we had an amazing event called Spread the Love with Sandwiches, and we made over 1,000 sandwiches in just a few hours for individuals on the downtown east side. So that was a really great way to get our participants involved with the campaign earlier than just like yep. 5 days. And so it was really great. Virgin Mobile provided us with so many free giveaways, the money to help budget for the event. And so our participants got to really get involved first thing, and they got to go down and help donate the sandwiches to Directions, as well as Covenant House and a few other selected charities and shelters. And so that's how they started initially. But aside from classroom presentations, they have a lot of media exposure during the event, which is not only helpful for the campaign, but I think individually it's really helpful because they get to kind of step out of their boundaries and kind of learn how to present and show why you're doing this, especially when it's such a, I find to be a controversial topic at some times.
It's something that, it's an initiative that I think we know started really with, I guess, the Sauter School of Business and there, but really seems to have spread across campus. It's really like a UBC-wide campaign now. Can you speak a bit to the growth it's experienced and the impact that it has on campus?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I can attribute that success to our executive team. I mean, Vicky and I, we both chaired it, but we had an incredible team. First of all, we had an external executive. He essentially contacted all the faculties and really developed a relationship there. So we ended up having 40% of external participants, so two from science, one from HKIN, and one from food. And that was incredible. Like, 5 days doesn't see that often. And on top of that, our marketing campaign was absolutely incredible. We spent a fair chunk of our budget on balloons alone, but I'm pretty sure a lot of people at UBC saw those balloons kind of popping around all over campus. And so that, plus our social media, plus just having a variety of people on our participant and on our executive team, really allowed us to tap into a variety of networks and maximize not only our exposure, but our fundraising.
Yeah, do you think this could potentially be, in future, a cross-faculty organized event?
Well, we were talking about that. I mean, it does sit under the commerce umbrella, so, and it's primarily a commerce event across Canada. I believe it is a commerce event across Canada. So in terms of chairing the event, I think it has to stay in commerce, which is kind of unfortunate because I think there's some very incredible candidates who'd be amazing who aren't in Sauter. But in terms of the executive team, we've had art students on the executive team before, and participant, I can see it growing a lot because we had a huge participant pool. We had 20 people who applied, and we could only choose 9 of them because we had already chosen a participant in September. So a lot of people want to get involved with this, and it's growing so quickly.
Yeah, and it's great if they can't be in the team, they can at least spread it through the social media or, you know, YouTube and things like that. So,
yeah, I guess just quickly, can you outline for us some of the criticisms that you guys face maybe on campus or from local media and how you counter that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the local media overall has been quite positive in terms of response. Mm-hmm. We were very fortunate to have the Globe and Mail come and do an article on us, I mean, that's across Canada. Mm-hmm. And they put us in a great light, but we had to deal with some of the commentary mm-hmm. written below. And so some of it was negative. They were calling us hipsters, and they're saying, like, oh, this is such a short-lived kind of thing where you just want to sleep outside. And it's like, are you kidding? First do your research before you make all these comments. And so, like, some people like that who aren't informed about it, I think, criticize us. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, I mean, people will walk by and they'll be like, I don't agree with what you're doing. But you have to listen to what we're speaking to. We're talking about the youth, and I see a huge difference between the youth and the adults on the street. It's just a whole different world. So, I don't know. I think it's really just be able to hit home and tell people that we're helping the youth. That will really resonate with most people, but it's definitely something we have to deal with every year. Our participants have to take the professors yelling at them and people walking on the street saying, we don't agree with you. But we also had people, bottle collectors. I mean, we had a bottle collector donate to us $2. I mean, $2 doesn't seem like a lot in the big scheme of things, but when you're a homeless person donating money to a cause, that says a lot to the people who are walking by the campus bookstore and they won't even donate 10 cents.
That's great.
Yeah, it was great having you in today, Kayla. Congratulations once again on 5 days, and we wish you the best of luck for next year.
Thank you so much.
All right, great. Take care. So that was Kayla Assel from UBC's 5 Day for the Homeless committee, which wrapped up last Friday. So we are going to take a quick break, but please do stay with us for your provincial headlines. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students.
The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Liveband.com is Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar. New shows are added daily by the city's most active promoters, musicians, and by the driving force of the music scene, the fans. Liveband.com's listings are different because they are integrated with profiles updated by bands and business owners as they promote upcoming events. Check out the archives to see how closely we've worked within the community to put on the shows you love. Visit LiveMusicVancouver.com for the latest independent and major label event listings. LiveVan.com, Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar.
Everyone, this will just take a minute. Introducing Serious Issues. Tuesday, March 20th at the Waldorf Hotel in the Tiki Bar. From 8 p.m. to late, Serious Issues is a party for young people interested in serious issues and partying. Featuring drinking, dancing, and short multimedia talks on creative actions by people from Adbusters, LeadNow.ca, DeSmogBlog, and Stuff Harper Did. Cover is cheap. Tickets are available at the door or through Eventbrite.ca. RSVP on Facebook to Serious Issues. And with DJs Cam Dales and Cameron Reed, the party is sure to be seriously good. That's all. You can get back to the serious dinner stuff. Thanks. Thank you.
Got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, Bunk?
Your neighborhood indie theater that promotes all things cool.
Fear not, the Rio lives on. This March at the Rio, catch The Bad Plus live Friday, March 9th at 7 p.m. sharp. From the 10th through the 13th, don't miss People of a Feather, featuring groundbreaking footage from 7 winters spent in the Arctic. People of a Feather takes you through time into the world of Inuit on the Belcher Islands in Hudson Bay. This film connects the past, present, and future within the unique cultural relationship between the Inuit and the Eider Duck. Wednesday, March 14th at the Rio, it's the Evil Bastard Karaoke Experience at 8 p.m. Thursday, March 15th, it's a live show with Patrick Maliha presenting the Legion of Stand-Up Comedians. For more of what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit riotheater.ca/schedule. To join the community fight back for the rights of the Rio Theater, visit facebook.com and search Rio Theater.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. It's time for your provincial headlines.
A BC woman is the lead plaintiff in a class action lawsuit seeking damages from the BC government on behalf of a group of women whose babies were allegedly taken from them at birth and put up for adoption. Lawyer Tony Merchant filed a statement of claim Friday in BC Supreme Court for a multi-jurisdictional class action lawsuit on behalf of unmarried young women in at least 3 provinces whose babies were allegedly taken from them. The suit is on behalf of Cassandra Armishaw of Trail, who is representing a group of young women who claim to have experienced similar events based on their status as young unwed mothers. The government of BC, through its social services department, has been named as a defendant in the lawsuit. The lawsuit includes a grave allegation of quote-unquote genocide. According to the suit, a UN convention defines genocide as the forcible transfer of children from one group to another. Quote, this was forcible in that the children were stolen from mothers at birth and, under care and control of the province of British Columbia through social services, were transferred to other parents who were married, end quote, the lawsuit alleges. The majority of the victims were sent to church-run homes for unmarried pregnant women, where they stayed for the duration of their pregnancy. After delivering their babies, social services allegedly took them away without the mother's approval. Hundreds of women are speaking out about how their babies were taken from them illegally and adopted over several decades across the country. Long shamed into silence, the women are now demanding answers about how a system that was supposed to protect them instead abused them and deprived them of their rights. Overall, the lawsuit includes a long list of allegations against BC's Social Services Department. It alleges discrimination against the class action members because of their age and marital status and a breach of their charter rights. It also accused the hospital and social workers of, quote, fraud, end quote, for not waiting 10 days to seek consent for adoption and for not providing independent legal counsel.
The BC government announced a pilot project Wednesday that will fly, house, and clothe BC's welfare recipients and unemployed should they want, quote, very high-paying jobs in the province's employee-starved rural communities. Jobs Minister Pat Bell said the goal of the project, which is still in development, is to find local eligible employees first, then cast a net in BC's metropolitan areas. A screening process will take place to judge the willingness of those to work and to determine if the individuals have mental health or addictions issues. Bell spoke of significant demands in the northeast region of the province, most notably in the Fraser-Fort George area, the Peace River region, and the central Thompson-Nicola region. The unemployment rate in the northeast of BC is the lowest in the province at 3.6%. Bell referred to a recent jobs fair held in Burns Lake in which over 30 companies were represented, offering over 1,300 jobs, ranging from mine work, jobs in the oil and gas sector, and other positions, including labor and skilled trade work. Quote, we are aware employers are finding it very difficult to fill these positions. We need to connect the dots and make sure that British Columbians are the first ones to take advantage of these very high-paying, family-supporting jobs. End quote, said Pat Bell. Dawson Creek Mayor Mike Bernier acknowledged there's widespread lack of affordable housing in the area. But there's great demand for skilled workers, such as Class 1 drivers, electricians, carpenters, and other trades in Dawson Creek. Meanwhile, NDP social development critic Carol James questioned whether it made sense to fly unemployed people to places like Prince George, where there are already lots of people looking for work and training. James said, quote, there are people in those communities right now who are unemployed, and they should be the first to get help, end quote.
Police have made a plea to the public for help in finding a missing 17-year-old girl from Lytton. Investigators believe Justine Abbott hitchhiked her way out of Lytton last Monday at approximately 10 a.m. and was spotted at an Agus's gas station before noon. Quote, since that time, police have been unable to determine Abbott's activities or whereabouts. There is no reason to believe that Abbott has left Agus's, end quote. This is what Lytton RCMP Constable Schenkenveld said in a release. Abbott stands 5'7", weighs 120 pounds, with a thin build. She is of First Nations heritage and has brown hair and brown eyes. Abbott was last seen wearing a red and black plaid jacket with black cuffs and a fur collar, a white hooded sweater, dark pants, and boots. RCMP are asking anyone with information to contact their local police or Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-8477.
And those are your provincial headlines. It's now time for your weekday weather forecast, brought to you by Phil from the UBC Storm Club. Over to you, Phil.
Go, Phil.
All right. Thank you, CJ. And good evening, listeners. Oh, noes. The end is here. It hailed. Relax, guys. And please stop sending me texts. Yes, I totally didn't see that coming. It is true that around 10 a.m. this morning, snow pellets precipitated from the cumulus clouds above us, whitening our rooftops. But that is no reason to jump to the conclusion that winter is returning. In fact, to put all our minds at ease, my friend and fellow classmate Andrew McLellan, after a chat with Ian McKenzie, one of our geobiosci profs here at UBC, assures me the opposite. According to what he learned, one of the key conditions for snow pellet formation is the land getting warmer around a large body of cold water. In other words, observing hail is actually an indicator that the average temperature of the landmass in our region is increasing. Bienvenue spring! Now, here's your 5-day weekday weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, cloudy. 40% chance of flurries or rain. Low of +3. Tuesday, cloudy with a 60% chance of showers. High of 7, low of 3. Wednesday, cloudy. High of 7, low of 3. Thursday, showers. High of 8, low of 3. Friday, also showers. It's spring, guys. It's spring. High of 9, low of 4. So that's your 5-day weekday weather forecast for UBC, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Currently, it is 6 degrees Celsius here on campus. I'm with CJ, Claire, and Iqbal in the sub. For News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
Great. Thanks for that, Phil, as always. We'll have to take your word on the fact that spring has sprung, and we're going to sit tight through that rain. So we're going to take a quick break right now. But please do stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Scan your Scotty Spanks butts. He scants when he struts. No one told him never to be rude.
Boy.
He dresses like a gangster.
He wrestled with an hamster.
He's here to get you all in the nude.
Boys.
And girls.
Not just this same old show on your radio. Scotty's Scenic Drive, Monday, 11 a.m. to noon, 101.9 FM, CITR Vancouver.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca. It's now time for your national news.
March break has come and gone, and a few flights were delayed, but luckily our economy did not plunge headfirst into irretrievable chaos. But there was a surge in sick calls among pilots, though. Add to that the inconvenience of some morning fog, and you get quite a few delays on one of the busiest travel days of the year. Air Canada is alleging that the pilots called in sick to purposely disrupt service, essentially a sort of backhanded strike in response to legislation that was passed last week that forbade Air Canada workers to strike or be locked out. So, the company has once again gone running to the Labour Minister and the Canada Industrial Relations Board to declare that the pilots' union authorized these backdoor strike tactics. If the board sides with Air Canada, the pilots' union could face fines of $100,000 a day, while individuals could get $50,000 per day. The Pilots Association is not bowing to the back-to-work legislation that received royal assent last Thursday, though. A union representative said Friday that the pilots plan to challenge the legislation in court.
While Air Canada, its employees, and the Industrial Relations Board get cozy with one another, another group of airline workers are being left high, dry, and jobless. A private company that maintains many of Air Canada's aircraft filed for bankruptcy today. Avios Fleet Performance Inc., Incorporated, posted notices yesterday at its plants in Montreal, Winnipeg, and Vancouver, informing their 2,400 employees to go home and not come back. About 200 protesters gathered this morning at Trudeau Airport in Montreal and blocked Air Canada employees from entering their offices. While confused workers pondered their newfound and sudden unemployment, Avios went to a Quebec Superior Court to seek bankruptcy protection. So now, while employees wonder whether they'll receive another paycheck from Avios, they and a few MPs are calling on, you guessed it, the Conservative government to intervene and set things straight. Not likely, says Labour Minister Lisa Raitt. Raitt says that since the company is seeking restructuring under the Creditors Arrangement Act, it is not necessarily a Labour issue.
And the NDP faces the end of two roads this week. On Saturday, the official opposition will elect its new leader. But today, voters in the Toronto-Danforth riding will decide who will occupy Jack Layton's vacant seat in the House of Commons. There are 11 candidates vying for the high chair, but polls show the NDP candidate Craig Scott with an almost insurmountable lead. The Liberals are also pulling out all the stops to take the seat. Grant Gordon has campaigned furiously with the help of interim Liberal leader Bob Rae, who held the riding as a New Democrat, Justin Trudeau, Stephen Dion, and Carolyn Bennett. There appears to be a lot on the line for the Liberals, who are eager to show that they still do have some political power. But as far as the Danforth riding is concerned, it looks as though the NDP will prevail. For a little bit more on Canadian politics, we go to a segment produced wonderfully by Martin Lemlin about the upcoming NDP leadership election.
Voters in Jack Layton's old riding of Toronto-Danforth are voting in a by-election today to fill the vacant seat left by the former leader of the NDP. While Craig Scott is expected to easily hold the seat for the Big Orange Machine, New Democrats are turning gears towards another vacant post left by Layton, the leadership of the federal NDP. Since
October, nine of the hopefuls have echoed each other's sentiments on many issues, politely encouraged each other, and occasionally, albeit meekly, pointed out each other's weaknesses. But now, in the week before the convention in Toronto, there are seven candidates left. And with only days remaining, things are starting to get a little heated. In a polite and respectful sort of way, of course. The gloves came off last week when patron saint of the New Democrats, Ed Broadbent, came out and publicly blasted the perceived frontrunner, Thomas Mulcair.
They don't know where he would stand on the inequality issue. They may have some hunches one way or another, but it has to be spelled out. They don't know where he is in terms of building a team and holding a team together in a coherent fashion, which is a big challenge for leadership, especially when you're in opposition.
Ed Broadbent led the NDP for 14 years in the 70s and 80s, and to many hardcore New Democrats, his word is law. But Broadbent's interference is an odd position for any party heavy to take. It's not like he just came out and endorsed Brian Topp, which he has done.
When I think of the leadership, I think of the person who has to take on Harper. And Brian is the man who could do that. And when I think about it, he's more ready today than either Jack or myself were when we became leaders. I deeply believe that. Through all the challenges and successes of the last 15 to 20 years, Brian's been there. The by-election breakthrough in the province of Quebec, he was there. At the highest level of Saskatchewan government with Roy Romano, he was there. The central figure in the campaigns under Jack's leadership, he was there directing the campaign. He is the natural person now to take us from official opposition to Government of Canada.
Since announcing his candidacy in September, Brian Topp has amassed a list of endorsements that would cause any New Democrat to spittle their orange crush all over their matching ties in a drooling envy frenzy. It's clear that he was, and is, the established power structure's choice right from the start.
Well, I think the first priority is to take on the key challenge facing the country. And the key challenge facing on the country is gross income inequality, the fact that we've slid into greater inequality than we've had since the 1920s, and that is blighting our country. It is leading to absolutely unacceptable levels of child poverty, nowhere worse than here in British Columbia, and many, many other issues that we have to deal with.
But Broadbent actually coming out and lambasting the man who's likely to win could obviously cause some problems. For instance, what if Mulcair actually wins? Broadbent will have played a pivotal role in decisively splitting the party in half, at a time when they need every scrap of unity they can muster. It seems outrageous that a man as politically savvy as Ed Broadbent would risk splitting his party like this. Now, as for Mulcair, he's a former Liberal, and some of his NDP colleagues don't like to hear his talk about bringing the NDP towards the center of the political spectrum. But Mulcair looks at it another way.
It's not a question of us wanting to bring the party to the center. It's a question of wanting to bring the center to us. We know that 61% of Canadians want a more progressive vision of Canada. 39% voted for Mr. Harper. So our first strategy has to consist on getting the people who don't vote or who don't vote anymore. And there's 40% of the Canadian population that didn't vote, including 65% of young people aged 18 to 25. Now, what we did in Quebec is we talked beyond our traditional base. That wasn't hard. We didn't have nearly as much of one in Quebec as existed in other provinces. But we talked to First Nations. We talked to cultural communities and new Canadians. We talked to young people and we brought them in. We got a lot of them elected. And that's been part of our success. So there was no contradiction between the campaign we ran in Quebec and the general campaign. But it was far more adapted. It was adjusted. It was attuned to the priorities of Quebecers. That's exactly what we have to do in the rest of Canada. So that's not a question of throwing aside any of our longstanding beliefs. That's simply a question of adapting, modernizing our way of explaining ourselves, our way of approaching people. You know, when you look at a place like Saskatchewan, where we failed for four general elections in a row to elect a single NDP MP, we realize that unless we change our approach, we're going to get the same result. So it's not a question of abandoning your ideals or what you represent. It's a question of adapting it and going after the people who might share your goals, share your vision, but who, for different reasons, just haven't voted for you.
What may be the most surprising thing of all is that that soft-spoken man you just heard is accused of being a loose cannon, a man who would control his caucus with turbulent bouts of temperamental anger. This information apparently comes from those who have worked closely with Mulcair, although his public demeanor seems pleasant almost to the point of fluffy down softness. A curious point about Mulcair, though. The CBC radio program The Current ran interviews with all seven NDP leadership candidates, with the exception of one. Repeatedly, Mulcair refused to take part in an interview that all of his fellow leadership hopefuls participated in. You can't honestly try to decipher Mulcair's reasoning for doing this, but it does make you wonder. Anyhow, there are other candidates other than Top and Mulcair, and Ed Broadbent has something to say about them as well. Broadbent recently offered as his second choice Peggy Nash, a former finance critic and a strong advocate of women's rights.
I want to go to work in the House of Commons to make sure that our caucus is as strong and effective going toe-to-toe with Stephen Harper in the House of Commons. But then I want to go to work organizing, building our riding associations, training organizers, and building our social democratic movement right across this country. Those are my priorities as well.
All of these weird endorsements are sure to have adverse effects on some candidates. Well, at least one. Broadbent basically chucked Paul Dewar to the curb by supporting Peggy Nash as his second choice. Paul Dewar sort of inherited Broadbent's Ottawa Centre riding, so you'd think that they'd be good buds. But I guess not. Dewar looked pretty strong 4 months ago, but he's lagging. Probably because of his abysmal linguistic skills in half of our national languages.
Je peux offrir l'expérience comme mon expérience comme le porte-parole pour les affaires étrangères, comme mon expérience dans la communauté. C'est très important pour le prochain leader de notre parti aime l'idée de la politique positive.
There are other candidates, of course. There's Nikki Ashton. She's a young spitfire who represents Churchill, Manitoba in the House. She's been carting herself around the country selling her idea of new politics, and it's been fairly well received. She's only 29 years old, but she's already making a mark for herself. And unlike Dewar, Ashton is fluent in something like 7 languages. Nathan Cullen is the only candidate from BC. He's a 4-term MP representing Skeena-Bulkley Valley. He has strong ideas about renewable energies and opposes oil pipelines. He's not likely to be a major factor in Saturday's election. But he's run a good campaign, and I'm sure he'll be recognized after this is all done because of it. And finally, Martin Singh, the bad boy of the NDP. Singh recently got an $1,100 fine from his own party for calling Brian Top a liar. An admirable feat, I know, but it is a testament, I suppose, to how tame the attacks have been in this campaign. Singh's a pharmacist from out east, and he has a pharmacare plan. I don't know what's in it, but anytime anyone talks to him about anything, he refers to his pharmacare plan. It had better be good, because he doesn't seem to know much about anything else. And that's that. Looks like a head-to-head showdown between Thomas Mulcair and Brian Top at this point, but we'll have to wait until this Saturday, March 24th, before we find out which of these 7 ambitious men and women will rise to the top of the political arena in Canada. And more importantly, what they do once they get there. There's a special thanks to Left Coast Blog, Straight Good News, and Paul Dewar himself for the audio clips. For CITR News, I'm Martin Lemelin.
And thank you, as always, for that well-produced piece by Martin Lemelin on the NDP leadership race. We look forward to seeing what happens with that. And now it is time for your international headlines.
France is on the highest security alert in its presidential campaign, on hold after a serial killer shot dead 3 Jewish children and a teacher in the worst attack on a school the country has known. The, quote, determined, cold, and methodical, end quote, masked gunman pulled up on a dark motor scooter at the gates of the Ozar-Hatorah Jewish school in Toulouse, southwestern France, dismounted and killed a 30-year-old rabbi and his 2 young sons, aged 6 and 3. After seriously injuring a 17-year-old boy, he chased an 8-year-old girl and shot her in the head at close range. The murder weapon was the same one used in 2 previous shootings, one last Thursday in which 2 soldiers died and a 3rd left in a coma, and another 4 days previously in which an off-duty soldier was shot dead. 3 of the men were of North African descent and 1 of West Indian origin. French President Nicolas Sarkozy said it appeared, quote, obvious that yesterday's attack was anti-Semitic and that he was suspending his re-election campaign. He said, quote, exceptional security measures, end quote, would be taken in the Midi-Pyrenees region. Officials raised the terrorist alert in the area to scarlet, the highest possible. Police were reported to be looking for 3 soldiers sacked for neo-Nazi activities. They were concerned that the gunman had widened his targets, going from shooting an individual to attacking a school. As a vigil was held at the school last night, a massive manhunt was underway, with hundreds of officers posted at schools and synagogues nationwide. Security was also stepped up internationally, with Jewish institutions from America to Sweden tightening security. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu led worldwide condemnation, suggesting that the attack was, quote, motivated by violent and murderous anti-Semitism.
The GOP primary contest continues to trudge along. Republican presidential hopefuls are in Illinois, launching an all-out assault for the state's 69 delegates. The contest has more or less been whittled down to Mitt Romney, who holds a commanding lead in nationwide polls, and Rick Santorum, who has consistently managed to snake votes away from the front runner in local elections. Ron Paul and Newt Gingrich are still in the race, but are virtual non-factors. As this contest wears on, the possibility of a brokered convention is quickly becoming a reality. Unless Mitt Romney can start decisively winning large states like Illinois, he'll almost definitely have to make a deal at the convention in August. Romney is fresh off a commanding victory in Puerto Rico, but recent polls show him in a neck-and-neck race with Rick Santorum in tomorrow's primary vote. And that is our program for today, March 19th, 2012. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you would like to share your comments or get involved with the show or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can also listen to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca or our past interviews on the News 101 page on mixcloud.com. For more independent news, join us Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for more editions of News 101. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced...